Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Catherine Newman, the Dean of the Arts and Sciences and a Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She is the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality, including The Accordion Family and The Missing Class. Her latest book, co-written with Ariane Delanoy, is After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Newman.
Thank you so much.
And today, April the 27th, is Freedom Day in South Africa. This is the 20th anniversary of when South Africa finally rid itself of the shackles of apartheid and became the democracy that it is. But it's still a lot of unfinished business.
That's right. I would call it a work in progress. And it bears all the hallmarks of a society in the making and trying to find its way from what was, of course, an officially organized form of repression and racial intolerance to a free democratic society with a functioning set of institutions and leadership that can be trusted. And it is not an easy transition at all, but it's one that South Africans are committed to.
Well, South Africa is, of course, has the dubious distinction of being the richest and the most unequal country in Africa. That, to my mind, was, of course, the great tragedy of these. Essentially, they were Nazis, the founders of the nationalist parties. Vervoort and Voster were on the run during World War II. They borrowed from a lot of Hitler's ideas, and they created this sort of anachronism of white power, which, had they been even a little bit more enlightened and had educated the majority and integrated that majority, South Africa would be a powerhouse today. It would dominate all of Africa. And, of course, on the other side, the black majority in protesting boycotted education. So is there still that deficit in terms of education and opportunity?
Well, let me start by saying that you could make a similar claim about the Jim Crow South in the United States, and it's important, I think, as we celebrate both the achievements and look at the remaining liabilities in South Africa, that we not forget that we, too, have evolved out of, in a halting way, our own American apartheid. And so I think we must credit the fact that both countries begin with a troubled past, and that was one of the reasons why I became interested in South Africa in the first place, as someone who studied the working poor in the United States, whose own heritage echoes the many, many decades of inequality they have suffered from. And it is true, certainly, that the period of the struggle, when millions of South Africans boycotted its institutions, that it left a trail, but I'm afraid that trail was long and deep already. The levels of educational inequality were so profound that that boycott might have just tossed a little bit more of the fuel on the fire, but fundamentally it was taking place on the against a background that was already unbelievably punishing to Africans and so-called colored people, especially in the Western Cape. That inequality persists today. There are still huge differences between the schools that serve the wealthy and schools that serve the poor. And it matters even more now than it did in the past. In the past, when skin color was really the dividing line, you had one set of coordinates for inequality. Today, because of affirmative action and a whole bunch of other legislative victories of the ANC, class really matters more than it did before. There are quite a few black Africans who've done very well and whose children are now doing well. And then there are millions who are mired in deep poverty. Hence, the class differences are becoming almost as pronounced as the racial differences once were.
So I'm not sure whether my question is irrelevant because it's a what-if question and certainly whether it's naive. But my sense is that South Africa has so much potential. It's already, you know, a democratic model and has the most advanced economy. I guess Botswana in many ways is probably the better example, but a small country. I mean, could it be the model for the rest of Africa? Because Africa, of course, is beset by, I mean, what's going on now in South Sudan, the newest African country, is so tragic. You can barely want to broach the subject, you know?
Yes, well, I think South Africa is a model in all of the positive and negative ways that models can be. It is a democratic society. Its institutions are functioning, but it also suffers from degrees of corruption and just punishing inequality. Because it is a wealthy country, as you pointed out, it has an unstoppable magnet for economic and political refugees. And as they come across the South African border, they are treated to the same kind of cold shoulder or worse that many Mexican migrants face in North America, and for similar reasons. The unemployment rates in South Africa are astronomical. And when more and more people arrive in the middle of a very high unemployment period, you get tremendous tensions, this time black on black. But they're nonetheless troubling. So it's a model in many ways. It does mirror some of the virtuous aspects of Northern Ireland and other trouble zones where a peaceful transition took place, but it's not perfect, and it's not even a question of glass half full, half empty. It depends a lot on what generation you are as to whether you think the country has the potential to become one of the great economic and social beacons of the Western world, or whether you think it's verging on becoming a failed state like Zimbabwe.
Again, I'm speaking with Catherine Newman, who's the Dean of the Arts and Sciences and a Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality, including The Accordion Family and The Missing Class. Her latest book, co-written with Ariane Delanoy, is After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa. So in terms of winners and losers, I guess, you know, you have white people, you profile seven people, black, white, colored, and immigrant. And the white people, of course, are living in sort of gated communities in a bubble. We've seen this trial of the so-called Blade Runner, Oscar Pistorius, which I'm not suggesting that he's any kind of example of that. But nevertheless, there's just such a gulf between. The difference, I guess, is that the white privilege hasn't ended. It's just that they're not racist anymore. And if anything, they're, you know, more inclusive, or I don't know whether it's motivated by guilt or what, but they are extremely apologetic about apartheid, but they haven't relinquished their privileges.
Well, I think that this is a complicated set of questions. First, right. I do think there's lingering racial discord. It's almost unmistakable. Second, it's true that whites retain tremendous advantages, but it's also the case that they, too, are now subject to the discipline of the market, which is why we profiled in the book one poorly educated white who is never going to be as poor as the poor Africans that we talk about, but who also is not going to enjoy much social mobility. He doesn't have very good job prospects, nothing like his father, because his father's generation was protected entirely by their skin color, and the son's generation is not. So justice has happened in the United States and other advanced industrial and post-industrial countries where education and class privilege is hugely powerful. Whites in South Africa are now distributed along a class spectrum that really matters. It didn't before. Your skin color was all that mattered in the past. That's not true anymore. Similarly, among the black Africans that we write about in this book, there are some who have been able to get a good education for all kinds of reasons of personal biography and now work in white-collar jobs in the City Bowl in Cape Town, and others who are living in some of the most abject slums outside of Cape Town. And that difference is not a difference of skin color. That is a difference of socioeconomic background or class. And so I do think we have to recognize these different forms of inequality are all operating at the same time. And that's partly because when South Africa was a pariah state and it was largely isolated, race was the only thing that mattered. But once it really rejoined the world economy, all of the pressures of globalization and competition began to fall on the country's shoulders. And that's one of the reasons why they have massive unemployment. Official unemployment that exceeds 25%, and of course among many groups is beyond 50%. And that is a heavy, heavy burden for the ANC to try and cope with, and a very heavy burden for the people who suffer from it.
Well, Catherine Newman, you brought up analogies to the American South, and I guess if you go back to the Civil War, I recall there was a movie about the Civil War called Cold Mountain, in which
one of
the characters was trying to understand the mentality of these white Southerners. And I think it was a doctor in a hospital full of Confederate wounded. And there was a group of sort of young Southern belles doing their charitable duty going through the wards. And the doctor says, you know, it always perpetually mystifies me why these poor white farmers and blacksmiths are fighting for the plantation owner's right to replace them with slaves. And
well, you know, South Africa's color bar, and much of the legislation that was the architecture of apartheid was an attempt to not only divide by race, but essentially to protect the work prospects of a poorly educated white population. The rich whites didn't really need that protection. They had everything. But the poor whites, of which there were a large number who were largely in the farming communities, were the ones who were agitating for that color bar, because the huge African population would have easily dwarfed them in competitive terms in the labor market. And that was one of the, I think many people are unaware of this, but it was one of the motive forces behind apartheid, was that labor market division. But I do think that there is this, it's impossible to imagine that in 20 years one could dismantle the kind of racial underpinnings of apartheid. It will take generations. And, of course, we've had our own long history and many, many generations past Jim Crow, and we still have our issues. So
well, arguably,
I don't think we would want to say nothing's changed, but we also wouldn't want to say we're in nirvana.
No, and in fact, you can make the argument that, in fact, in some ways, we're turning back the clock. The Supreme Court just ruled against affirmative action and also against the Voting Rights Act.
Exactly.
So
unfinished business, lots of it.
So, but is there an analogy, though, with the South becoming a Republican Party and the white minority in this, or the whites in this country, feeling that they're becoming minority, and in many ways racism is being revived as a kind of glue against the demographic changes that seems to be disturbing so many people who vote?
Well, I think there are some analogies, but there are also, of course, vast differences. I mean, the black population in South Africa is the numerical minority by a mile, by many miles. And so in a majority rule democracy, it's inconceivable that whites will be able to take the kind of power that we see in the American South. At the same time, the economic concentration of wealth in white hands obviously has its privileges. And so the politics and the economics don't add up in exactly the same fashion. But I think the wild card here is the black political elite and where it's going and who it represents. And therein lies a tale in South Africa, because we have seen steady increases in corruption. We have seen real problems of legitimacy in the leadership there. And I think that story has yet to be finished. It's almost barely written as to whether or not South Africa can generate a leadership in the post-Mandela period that has anything close to the moral mantle that he carried. Certainly the leadership in place now doesn't have it. And that is leading to a degree of cynicism and declining voter participation that I tried to explain in this book. The generation that is now coming of age, that are in their 30s, don't feel the kind of solidarity and affection for the ANC that their parents did. Their parents were the ones on the front line of the struggle and would never think of voting for anyone else and would never think of not voting, since they sacrificed so much for the right to vote. But their children are becoming disillusioned, and it's having its consequences in their sense of political trust.
Well, there's no question that Nelson Mandela was one of the greatest gifts that history has ever provided, being the right man at the right time, and obviously having suffered for so long in isolation. So he's a tough act to follow. That's
very tough.
And it seems it has gone downhill with Mbeki, and now with Zuma. It's heading in the wrong direction. But is that a condition of just the fact that Mandela was so extraordinary?
No, I don't think it's only that. I think that the sources of political legitimacy remain, at least for the moment, in the role that these different leaders had during the anti-apartheid struggle. So Jacob Zuma, whatever his failings may be as a leader, could lean very heavily on his involvement in the struggle itself. I mean, he was a real warrior for the anti-apartheid forces. And many of the exile blacks who were far away fighting the battles in another zone, especially the economic boycotts and so on, which were pretty important in bringing apartheid down, don't have the kind of credibility that those who were really on the streets have. One more generation, and I'm not sure that will be the case anymore. So some of what you see in the political struggles in South Africa has to do with how people demonstrate their bona fides. And that's just a complicated historical moment in the country.
Well, when you were speaking earlier, Catherine Newman, about South Africa being a magnet for poor, desperate people coming in from the north, the border with Zimbabwe, of course, is where so many desperate people are trying to get out of Mugabe's Zimbabwe into South Africa, and they have a terrible time crossing that border. But Zuma and others support Mugabe. So where's the logic in that?
Well, I mean, Zuma is a complicated character, and I don't pretend to understand the logic there, and I certainly couldn't justify it. It's very upsetting. You know, the politics of Africa have long reflected these dubious commitments and sort of triangulated loyalties. When you go back into the history of the ANC and you learn that, you know, the independence movements that swept Africa were a source of great hope for the ANC until they discovered that these newly independent countries were not willing to jeopardize their trading privileges with the West to support the ANC. So it's a complicated history with shifting loyalties and forms of self-interest that are not easily added up. But there is no question in my mind that Zuma's support for Mugabe is tantamount to supporting massive human rights violations, and it certainly doesn't endear him to most South African voters.
Well, just in closing, Catherine Newman, what is your conclusion, though, in along with Ariane Delanoy, who's a sociologist at the University of Cape Town, your new book, After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa, given the economic disparity, and of course here we are in the new Gilded Age here in the United States, so who are we to speak about economic disparity? But what's your prognosis about closing that gap?
I think it's going to take generations to close that gap. It is so enormous. I have spent time in the Eastern Cape with families whose children are suffering from malnutrition, where there's no employment at all anywhere, and the only form of economic sufficiency is coming from state allowances, which, to their credit, the ANC created. There was never any such protection before, but it's pretty meager. So I think what we all have to understand is that throughout Mandela's career, and even now under Zuma, there is a tremendous amount that the ANC is attempting to accomplish, but the need is so enormous that it will take generations, sadly, to address it, if indeed they invest wisely to begin with, and that's always a question mark. So it's a country that I have deep affection for, deep admiration for, just as I do my own, and you recognize its failings just as we recognize our own. And that's why I wrote After Freedom with Ariane Delanoy, because we thought 20 years after Mandela's election, it was time to step back and ask where it's going.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Catherine Newman.
My pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
Again, I've been speaking with Catherine Newman, who's the Dean of the Arts and Sciences and a Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She is the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality, including The Accordion Family and The Missing Class. Her latest book, co-written with Ariane Delanoy, is After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa. And she joined us on Freedom Day in South Africa, which is today, 20 years from the end of apartheid. We're going to take a brief station break and be back, joined by this former senior advisor to Ron Paul's presidential campaign and the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon.